Welcome to Blind Shovel, an arts and music podcast. Today I speak with musician Mandla. Enjoy. Mandla. What's up, dude?
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Happy evening. Late evening for you and evening for me.
Fantastic.
How are you feeling? Are we started?
We're in it.
We're in it.
We're just in it.
Oh my God. You add the intro music in post.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a live band.
We'll fix it in post. Yeah, no, okay, that's okay. That's okay. I thought Dory was going to come on here and you guys were going to have
sick.
Some little quippy interaction.
That would be cool. I should think about that one day, a live one with, it's like a Jimmy Fallon type thing going on, you know?
I don't think you need to be any more similar
like Jimmy
to
Fallon?
Jimmy Fallon than
yeah, well.
You need to be.
So first of all, what is your, I never asked you this, but what kind of name is this that you have?
Mandla. My name, my full name is Mandlenkosi. Mandla is a nickname. It's a Zulu name.
Wait, so your full name is just one word? Or?
Yeah, it's 11 letters. My full name is Mandlenkosi.
Okay.
And you don't have to try it. And and Mandla is the shortened version of it. So Mandlenkosi means strength of the Lord in Zulu. And it's two words put together, Nkosi, which is the Lord or God, and Mandla, which is strength or power. And Mandlenkosi is like a pretty common name, and Mandla is the nickname, and you might hear the like rallying cry against apartheid. Mandla Soweto, Amandla Soweto, power to the people.
Interesting.
Yeah. And
but how do you get that name?
How do I get that name? Well, I grew up in Southern Africa. I grew up in South Africa and Zimbabwe. My family, my parents moved to South Africa in 1980. And we lived in South Africa till 1990-91, and we lived in Zimbabwe till 2000. So I wasn't born there. My sister was born in South Africa in 84. And then in 87, my parents came back to the States for a six-month period. And I was born during that six-month period in Bangor, Maine.
Okay.
I don't know where that is.
Inappropriate.
But I don't know. I was born there, but I don't know. I've never been to Bangor otherwise. And then we were back home in Mfanafile, in KwaZulu-Natal, which is about 200 kilometers north of Durban. Very, very, very rural. So like...
But why? What's going on? Why are your parents...
They're both ministers. They're both pastors. My dad was in the Peace Corps. He went to West Point. His dad's an FBI agent, so he went to West Point, and then he had an awakening and realized he didn't want to be an instrument of death. He wanted to be an instrument of light and life, and he realized West Point was doing the job and turned him into a hard-shelled individual, angry kind of person. So he dropped that and he went to divinity school. He went to the University of Chicago. Meanwhile, my mom, she grew up in San Francisco and she kind of like dropped out of high school early and started community college when she was like 15. And then she eventually got to the University of Chicago and they met and fell in love. And my dad was like, I did the Peace Corps. He did the Peace Corps in Senegal. And then he said he told my mom he wanted to go back to Africa. And she was like, cool, let's get married and do that. So in 1980, during apartheid, they moved to South Africa. And initially they were placed at a school and they were teaching. I think my dad was teaching math and my mom was the chaplain because she was ordained before him. And then he got ordained. And then the two of them worked for the UCCSA, United Congregational Church of Southern Africa. And they got placed, you know, it's apartheid South Africa. So we, you know, legally everything's segregated, right? It's illegal for, you know, whites to live with blacks and blacks to live with whites. And so they initially got posted in this little town. Oh my God, I'm going to blank on it. Melmoth, I think. And which was the white town. And obviously my folks were like, well, this is problematic. Mm-hmm. And so they said, you know what, we're going to live. There was a manse, a little manse next to the church in Mfanafile. And they said, you know what, we're going to move out there and kind of fly under the radar. And which they did. So we moved to a black zoned area in KwaZulu-Natal and we lived there till 1990, 91. Like I was saying, Mandela got released. And then as the story goes, as I recall it, I was a little guy. So I've just been told, you know, the white government in power really started freaking out once Mandela was released. And so they started cracking down on, you know, white foreigners who were living illegally. So they kicked my folks out. They said, look, you either move back to the white township or you right. leave. And so my folks were like, well, you know, we're not going to do that. So they left. And then we had a short stint in New Hampshire because, had some family in New Hampshire. So I had a couple of cold winters. And then we moved to Zimbabwe, and Zimbabwe is kind of tight. Zimbabwe is just north of South Africa, and a group of Zulus left Shaka Zulu, and they moved north, and they created the Ndebele tribe. And so where we moved in Zimbabwe was mainly Ndebele speaking. And so Ndebele is like a very similar language to Zulu, because Zulu is my first language. So Ndebele and Zulu are like British and American English. It's like, it's the same language. It's obviously different with like different accents and like slightly different pronunciations, but essentially it's the same. So that was kind of helpful. And Mandla works in both languages. So I got to show up the only white kid with my sister and thank God we both had Zulu names. So, that was one less thing to have to explain.
What's her name?
Her name is Tandiwe, which means beloved. Tandi for short.
Okay, so I'm trying to connect these dots. So I'm assuming that was fairly musical upbringing.
Oh, yeah. Church. I mean, I was raised in the church and in South Africa. I mean, so where we lived and the churches we were going to that were out pretty rural, it's all just a cappella singing.
Interesting. And you're good at singing.
Yeah, I can sing.
Can your sister sing?
She love you, Tandiwe.
We'll
she's not as good a singer as I am.
I only ask because like I'm assuming almost everyone is good at singing in this context if you grow up singing.
You know, my sister didn't catch the bug. I mean, she certainly sang at church. She sang at church, but like, you know, if you're going to sit down, I think like she hasn't done it as much as I have. So I would say she probably doesn't have like a foundation for like what works with her voice. So she'd have to like figure out like what octave am I going to sing this in?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like,
so let me take a step back. What denomination is this?
Okay, so UCCSA, United Congregational Church of Southern Africa. My My folks in the States are part of a liberal denomination called UCC, United Church of Christ. And the UCC have had women pastors for a century, and they've certainly been doing LGBT, lesbian, gay marriages for a long time. So UCC is an open and affirming. It's what it's called, open and affirming church. So mm-hmm. when they say everyone's welcome, they really mean everybody's welcome. And when they say everyone's welcome, they also mean their church leadership and their pastors will be a living embodiment, a testament to that. You know, mm-hmm. if you go to the UCC church in Los Feliz, Pastor Ashley Heastand, you know, she's a lesbian pastor. So I grew up with, you know, those couple of years when we were in New Hampshire in the 90s, you know, the organist married the choir director, women. And so my folks did this lesbian marriage, you know, out by the lake, and we went to that in 1991. So for me, I was raised in a very, what I would call, you know, welcoming, positive interpretation of Christianity and the church and what that could be. Mm-hmm. And even though I would say that's probably not the case in Southern Africa and in the UCCSA, probably some more problematic things going on there in terms of LGBTQ plus stuff. I would say the church in general would still today, because the damage is done. Don't get me wrong. They had missionaries going over there and converting people. My parents don't convert people. That already happened. So now, unfortunately, or whatever, there are already generations of of African Christians living there. The damage has been done. But now, as it exists with these generations who are raised Christian, the church can really act as, I don't know, what I think are supposed to be its foundations, which are like a communal support group. And so, you know, when the poorest in your community needs something, or when, you know, someone has a child who needs a wheelchair and they don't have money for a wheelchair, these poor churches will get together and figure it out. And to me, I mean, that's like a beautiful thing.
So do you still go to church?
I do on occasion. I've come back to it a bit.
You have children now, right?
I do have kids. I do have kids. And I think that my wife, Claire, is not religious. So when I was in college, my first year in college, I had a friend in college who had a car. She's actually the pastor of Los Feliz UCC. Crazy, Ashley Heastand. She and I went to undergrad together. She was a senior. She had a car my freshman year, so she would take me to church. I'd go to church with her. And then she graduated, and I didn't really have any other, like, friends I knew who were going to church, other than, funny enough, my, like, musician friends who, like, played in church bands.
Right.
But I didn't go to their churches. Like, for them, it's like work, you know? It's like a morning of work, so I didn't want to go to work. So I didn't go to church for a long time, and then in the pandemic, when the pandemic hit, my older sister is a pastor now. And so I hit her up. I was like, Tandiwe, I'll jump on Zoom because your church is on Zoom now. We can all do this Zoom church thing. And she was like, well, you could do that, or Ashley Heastand's the local pastor, our friend. So I said, what the heck? So I jumped on that Zoom. And then once the pandemic ended, and I wouldn't say I go every week or anything like that, but often enough that, you know, people got to know me a little bit. And now when I'm not going to some birthday party, some kid's birthday party, then we might rally and pop over to the little UCC church in Los Feliz. It's a very small community. It's probably 20 to 30 people. Generally leans on the older side, as a lot of old, like, older Christian like groups do. They're kind of dying out. And so this, you know, this little group of 24, 25 people, and then I rock up with my fam and we're mm-hmm. five people and we roll in with like all the kids like, and they're loud and Hope. Like, and they're laughing. Yeah, no, the church freaking loves it, man. These people are like, what? Loving it. They started putting the, like, they have some like kid play stuff that they put out for the kids to use. They start putting it at the front of the church.
That's right.
So we sit at the front of the church. Anyway, it's a riot, but it's cool.
But
it's
in, nice, in respect, you know, to the distinction musically from what you experience in America in these churches,
yeah,
versus Africa,
yeah,
is it
the churches I'm going to is different,
right? Like
yeah.
Same quote unquote denomination, right?
Yeah,
but totally different environment.
So and totally different music. I mean, when if in your mind you have a cliche of a church in South Africa that's all black people and they're singing, that
I do.
Was,
that's in my mind.
That is what we were living. That is our experience. That's my lived experience. And it is beautiful and it's incredible. And there's no music in the hymnals. Like maybe the hymnals will have the poems, the words, the lyrics, but the melodies, there's no organist, there's no piano player. So the melodies exist in the elders' minds, and some elder, some gifted elder is like a music book, and they'll just start the song and then the whole congregation just follows the elder for the melody. Like, and people just naturally harmonize. Like, I mean, it's so ridiculously beautiful. It's awesome. So that's me growing up. And then come over to the States, and me personally, the churches I went to, you know, the music is fine, but like a little, like pretty stale, I would say.
Sure.
Not to say you can't find great churches with great music, but at times, you know, for me, I will say I will sacrifice music for a better, more open community that aligns with my views.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not going to go to a church with amazing music and they're like, but by the way, if you're gay, you're burning in hell. How about, whoa,
right.
hold up. Oh my God. The music's not that good.
Did you even know? It sounds like you were so immersed in music and religious experience that, I mean, I imagine it's part of your fiber. But you don't make music in that vein, right? To my knowledge, you don't make...
No, I don't make religious music.
No. Have you ever even imagined music. What that would be?
You know... No, well, I mean... I went to undergrad and I did music for undergrad and I had to do a senior project and that had to be I did composition. So it had to be a hour long, performance of music that I'd composed and it had to be a mix of electronic, instrumental and choral other music. And I think I threw some song in and the lyrics were Alleluia over and over again. But I think that was probably just me being lazy and being like, okay, I gotta throw in a choir piece.
So I'll do it. So how would you describe the music you make?
The music I make now?
Yeah.
Oh man. Music I make now is like very guitar, rock, punk, pop, up like happy music. I would say if you turned it on and listened to it, you'd be like, oh, this is pretty happy music. But it's guitar based. It's very guitar based in my band, Ugly Sweaters. It's, you know, guitar, bass, drums, and sometimes synthesizer, but it's like jangly.
And so how did you end up there from where you started? How did you get to this punk?
So,
wait, first of all, you also went to school for composition, if I understand correctly?
Yeah, I went to Occidental College, which is a liberal arts school in the neighborhood of Eagle Rock in Los Angeles, California. And so I got a liberal arts education. I minored in film. I took some religious studies classes. I thought maybe I would do religion, but my friend, I had a conversation with my buddy Hank, and Hank was like, dude, why are you doing religious studies? You really should just be a music major. Cause that's what you like. That's like, you know, that's what you love, I guess. So I ended up dropping the religious major completely. I did music composition, and so I did study that. But growing up, you know, until I was 13, you know, I didn't have a piano in the house. I didn't have guitars in the house. I mean, we lived in rural Zimbabwe, and I had no instruments in the house. So I only sang, and we had a tape deck. And my uncle, my dad's youngest brother, used to send us mixtapes to Zimbabwe. And so I had these mixtapes that I listened to on this tape deck. And that stuff was like Beatles, Bob Marley, David Bowie, Blondie, stuff like that, and Talking Heads. Like, I didn't even know these are on mixtapes with like nothing written on them. And so I would just listen to these tapes. My sister and I would just listen to these tapes. And then as my life went on, as I grew, I would be at a party, or I would find a record from the library and I would play it. And then like some track would come on, I'd be like, Road to Nowhere is a Talking Heads song on this random Talking Heads album. Had no clue. I was like, I thought that was just after, you know, some, you know, David Bowie's Starman on this mixtape I had. So I've discovered like what those songs were as my life has like progressed, which has been like super weird.
So it sounds like, is it fair to say that there's like a two distinct chapters going on?
Yeah.
Was there a time where the floodgates open and then you're suddenly informed about all this music and all this potential?
Oh yeah. So we moved from Zimbabwe. So in 2000, Robert Mugabe, who was the president of Zimbabwe, and unfortunately at that time dictator, he'd very much been like a liberator, positive looking president in 1980 when Zimbabwe got independence. But by 2000, he was still the president. Kind of tells you everything. Anyway, there was a big push to return land that whites were occupying and owned in Zimbabwe and give that back to the black Zimbabweans. And that was at times a violent exchange of land. And so we got 2 weeks notice in 2000 from the UCC church to my parents. They said, look, it's hairy out there. You guys got to get out because you're living in rural areas and people don't know the difference between a white farmer who owns land and a white minister. You both are driving trucks.
Right.
You both are driving these pickup trucks. So we had 2 weeks, moved back to the United States. And I was like, a month before I turned 13, my sister's like a month before she turned 16, and we moved to Cleveland, Ohio.
How are these decisions being made? I don't understand. Is the
UCC like... church headquarters are in downtown Cleveland.
Okay. All right.
And so my mom, she gets a job at the headquarters, and she, I guess, is like a liaison or something for folks were about to go overseas. So she's helping them out. My dad, like, thank God my parents had the foresight about like culture shock and everything. My dad did not get a job. He stayed at home, dad, and just helped me and my sister with like acclimate to this like culture shock that was moving from rural Zimbabwe to Cleveland Heights, Ohio. And
okay. Yeah.
And in that move, I made some new friends through choir. I joined the choir and Cleveland Heights choir. I mean, I went to that high school. That high school is 75% black, and the choir was like, there were like four white kids in that choir. I was like, I'm right at home, man. Let's go. And the choir was amazing. And that music was like absolutely insane. We did spirituals. We did all kinds of incredible music. I learned the Black African-American national anthem. I mean, all kinds of stuff. And my friend Isaac realized this kid had just moved from Africa and didn't know much. And so he burned me a Beastie Boys CD and an Outkast CD. I think it was Aquemini and Beastie Boys must have been Paul's Boutique. And from there, it just like snowballed. I was like, amazing, loved it. And I started listening to a lot more rap music. My sister's friend Colin burned me Metallica's Injustice for All. So he was like, you're going to love this. So my parents didn't get me Metallica's and Justice for All.
How open were they to that?
They were down. My parents didn't care. My parents didn't care. And I would say my mom, even more so, like she would let me put on whatever in the car. And I used to love going on car rides. Like, oh my God, let's go to the store. Amazing. I can listen to some music in the car. I did that like a lot. I would go on tons of errands with my mom just so I could like put on a CD in the car and kind of turn it up, you know?
Was there ever a line you could cross in respect to like music?
Musically, like to listen to with my parents?
Yeah. For instance, my parents wouldn't let my brother, I mean, it's hard to stop a kid from listening to something, but they didn't like that he listened to KMFDM. If you're familiar with that.
No, what's KMFDM?
Oh, wow. It's interesting. Like they were the band really associated with Columbine, but nobody knew who they were. So everyone just said Marilyn Manson was the problem.
Oh, so interesting.
KMFDM is actually really interesting music. It's absurd. But was there ever a time where they were like, all right, this is getting a little, I mean,
No. I think my folks totally understood that like anything that's going to be crazy music, whatever that means, whether it's lyrically explicit, violent, over-sexualized, whatever. I think actually, now that I said, I don't think they would care about that. They would not be down for like homophobic lyrics.
That's the line.
That would be the line. So if I'm listening to rap music, fine. But if you're listening to rap music and they're dropping slurs, then and they're dropping homophobic slurs, that my folks would be like, no, we're not gonna listen to that. And I mean, I knew that too. Like me growing up, like I did not grow up saying homophobic slurs or anything like that. You know, so me like right away, even I could self-censor. I don't find that much enjoyment out of music that, you know, it might have said that. I was like, oh, I can't really sing along. I can't rap along to this. I can't say that. Even in my bedroom, that's not, you know, I'm not down for that.
All right. So that was their line. I was just curious. I have,
like, yeah.
I have, you know, my parents are just like people, you know, there's no grand narrative. Mm-hmm. Like your childhood sounds like, how do I word it? It sounds like the childhood of like a past generation to me. Like there's a lot of substance and historical relevance. And whereas I feel often with my generation, you just have like a childhood and it's not eventful per se. Mm. And it feels like it exists in some liminal space where you're kind of oblivious to things.
Mm.
But how old are you again?
I'm probably the same age as you.
Yes, I'm exactly.
So 1987.
Okay, I'm 88. So like.
Oh, okay, yeah.
This is why I'm fascinated by the origin story here. But also because I feel that your music is, I don't know how much there is to say about it. It feels good. It's upbeat. It's fun. But I don't imagine that you're sitting there, you know, ripping your hair out, trying to figure out your whole content. But I could be wrong. So talk to that.
No, mute, like lyrically?
Yeah.
Oh, man. No. Like my stuff is much more, I don't know. I'm not a tortured soul or anything like that. And I think my songs are are often like experiences, like little journal entries of a moment or an experience or something like that. And usually like a collage, you know, so it's not that like one thing will be all from one story, but you know, it'll be like, oh, where'd you get this line from? Oh, this happened to me. You know, where'd you get that line from? Oh, this happened to me. No, I wouldn't. It's not like I'm like explicitly saying, oh my God, I grew up in Africa.
Yeah. You know. It's not autobiographical. But so with that kind of process, first off, is Ugly Sweaters the main representative of your output?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Ugly Sweaters is like my, for sure.
Okay.
My voice.
So I'm always more curious about these kind of more intuitive processes. Like, what doesn't make the cut and why? Is this again just an intuitive sorting process where you're just saying, well, this doesn't feel quite right? Or it looks to me like you put out an album every 4-ish years, kind of. So what is going on? Because that's some it's always interesting to me that rock often takes like 4 years, like even like
it's a 3 chords. You're like, wow.
Yeah, it's just interesting. There's like different pacing.
How hard did Montla have to think to do a 1-4-5 progression? And, you know.
No, I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing.
I'm not saying it's bad either. Trust you me, Michael. I'm not saying it's bad.
There's space for life between those. There's breath between, you know, 4 years, things happen. And then there's reasons to make more work. Oftentimes, I think people make so much work that I don't know what they're actually experiencing in life between those outputs. Mm. And then it just becomes artificial in some way.
Well, I will say that, and I feel like I'm not alone here, Radiohead.
Okay. All right, yeah.
Just me and Radiohead. Fair. I feel like Radiohead put out some record recently, and a bunch of internet people were like, oh, dang, they included this song on the new record. The first time they played that song was 15 years ago. And it didn't make it onto any record, and now it's here. And so that I only say that story because for me, like I have put out, we've worked on these basically, you know, I know you said albums, that's nice of you. These EPs or whatever, these kind of longer EPs. But some of those songs have been, they've come up because Alex Fender, who plays bass, has been like, oh, remember that one song we used to play? We never recorded that. And I'm like, oh my God, you like that song? Validation. I love that song. And then we'll record that even though it's really old. So all's to say, like, just because I'm putting out, you know, a batch of 5 songs in 2024, really, like, those songs, you know, if anything, they were probably recorded in the last 12 months. And then if anything, they were written, you know, in the last 3 to 4 years, maybe more. And just like didn't make the cut. Also say, I write all the time.
You write all the time. So, yeah, I'm trying to understand. I think people have different levels of urgency in terms of the capture. Terms of, especially with music, I think, because music is much more ephemeral. So I imagine, and maybe with the way you grew up, I could imagine like songs of devotion, they really aren't about capture and commodification. So do you have a bunch of stuff but the urge to package it is less appealing?
So I think it's like, you know, just for some listener context, you know, I mean, Ugly Sweaters is me, Claire, Alex, and Ian. So this 4-piece. And Claire and I, we don't make money doing music. And Alex and Ian only make money doing music. And they don't make their money doing music with Ugly Sweaters. Mm-hmm. And with all that in mind, what it means is the way Ugly Sweaters, like my dream growing up, like once I moved to Cleveland, and then I didn't even mention, so then 2.5 years later, we moved to Australia just before I turned 16. And that was even the bigger move to music and like bands, because in that moment I had this library knowledge of music, but no real output. I'd maybe started trying to write songs, and I moved to Australia and I was in Melbourne and I had no friends. And the way I made friends is I was in music class in high school, and I went up to some people and I was like, have you guys ever played in a band? And they're like, no. Sure. I was like, let's form a band. And so we started doing like rock stuff and writing and putting that out. But also say my dream, like for me in like the, and it's so naive in terms of as a listener, as a consumer of music, but my dream was like, you make music with your friends.
Sure.
And I think like, that's like such a rarity to actually like make music with your friends and like be financially successful or popular or anything. Like that's less the case than like the reality of like, oh, like we started getting big and then we heard Dave Grohl was a good drummer. So he joined the band and we made Nevermind. And in my mind as like a listener, I'm just like, oh, they're all buddies.
Yeah, that's how I used to feel about sports teams.
Yeah, right.
I always thought they were like best friends. And then I realized, oh, they actually, most of them hate each other.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that's logical, right? Like there's a sacrifice to be made. And unless you have that really crazy outlier.
Right.
Where the band, they're all friends and no one's having sex with each other,
right.
Which adds a whole nother level of complexity. And that doesn't go wrong. And like, I think it's just natural that, I mean, tension is a good thing too. It's kind of a tricky balance.
Sure.
There can be too much comfort between friends.
Uh-huh.
And so, no, but I get you. Yeah. The idea.
So
like
that
you think,
idea, that dream. And for me, then once Alex joined the band, he's so good. And then Ian joined a little bit later, and Ian's so good that for me and my output and what we create as Ugly Sweaters, and I mean, oftentimes the shows that we play and stuff like that, they're very much like based around like, as long as I live in LA and they live in LA, it's the most fun. Like, that's why I say like our band is fun. It's not even just the music is fun, but like we are friends. We do shows together that we all can make it to, which means we play a lot less shows because Alex and Ian tour. They right. they travel around the country and the world and they play with these bands that they make money with and stuff like that. But for us, it feels organic, and I swear it still feels like my high school band. Like getting together with my friends. Like when we rehearse, it's like, I don't know. I feel like it's just so different from the things that I see a lot of my other like musical peers, like when they get gigs or when they join some other groups or whatever, you know, like it's a real job. If you like a lot of things, you know, it's going to be a real job. If you have to make money off of it, and it's gotta be like successful in that sense. But for me, I'm like, I don't know, you know, I just want to play music with my friends. I just want to play live with my buddies. And so I think that has more so impacted like that slow release of stuff. It's like, it's just like whenever we can wrangle everybody together and squeeze some songs out, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Is it required that you have fun while making music for you? Is it a requirement?
I haven't put myself in a situation where I don't have fun creating music. Not necessarily making music like because obviously you're making music if you're in a choir and you go to choir rehearsal and practice and stuff like that, you know, but I mean, like making music, like we're making some like original music. I can't not have fun with it. I don't know. I no, can't.
It's always interesting to talk to artists and musicians about how much fun is at play. And the answers wildly vary.
Yeah.
You know, often related to the mission.
Uh-huh. And, right. Right.
And, but that says a lot about someone. Uh-huh. So it isn't, I mean, maybe this is a stretch, but it seems like songs of devotion are meant to uplift the spirit.
Mm.
And obviously in a transcendent way.
Mm-hmm.
Fun often skews a little more towards like a hedonic openness, but they're definitely related.
Yeah.
Do you think that's where it comes from? Like the purity of your experience of music early on? That you just wanted to remain pure and open and uplifting, and you're not interested in kind of layering on the careerism or the business side of it?
Oh, I mean, I don't know how to do business.
Yeah.
Look at my music career. I don't know how to do business. I don't know how to do that. Doesn't interest me. I don't know how to do a record release, you know, like I don't know how to do a PR campaign, but I can write you a song or I can sing along. If you play, I can sing, I can come up with lyrics and I can write a song and I'm going to love it. And it's going to be so tight and so fun to sing. And you are not even going to be able to not have fun because we're going to have a physical connection on stage. I'm going to lean on your shoulder or I'm going to push you over. I mean, I feel like the last show I played, I like smashed Alex's bass guitar with my guitar by accident. And I was like, oh, dang. And I'm like, but then I'm like, his guitar's fine, my guitar's fine. And also, like, how many other shows is he playing? We're like, we're doing, you know, like, I don't know. We just have so much fun with it. So I don't know. I forgot the question. I have too much fun.
No, it was just about how much, it sounds like fun is a priority in this process.
Yeah.
And if you were to not have fun, you probably wouldn't continue making the music.
No. I assume. No. Yeah, no. And that's why I think it's fun to make music with people, you know, you like and you care about. And I don't know. I could play a show with somebody who maybe I didn't like and they were playing a certain part. I'm like, okay, that person's playing that part. But I like everybody else and maybe we did. Maybe they just jumped in because they can read music and they learned the part really well. But I don't really read music that well, you know. That's why it's cool playing with Ian and Alex, because Ian is a better guitar player than I am, and Alex is a better guitar player than I am. and I play guitar. and I feel like I don't have to ever, I get to be my complete self whenever we perform, and those guys are so, and Claire are so in tuned with the way I perform that they know that it's like pretty organic and it can be you know, unexpected at times, and maybe we'll start a song too fast. Usually everything's played too fast. And I just know that I can stop playing and like dance, or I can jump off stage, and I, you know, and Alex, Ian, and Claire, they'll just go. Like it, the show is not going to be affected. It's right, still going to be so good. And, yeah, it's just like, it's pure joy for me. And I feel like that organically, you know, I always like to say, I feel like we're going to have a fun time. We're going to have like a great time at Ugly Sweater Show.
This is slightly tangential, but I'm kind of curious. You wouldn't describe having children as fun, would you?
I would not describe it as complete fun.
No, what I mean by that is like, this is not me diminishing the magic. There's obviously a lot more struggle and there's a challenge present in that.
Yeah, you work real hard for the good times.
Exactly.
You work real hard for the good times.
So I think for some people that art making and music making has that dynamic where it is laborious and it is maybe pragmatic at times, and it has some other goal in mind. It has some other ambition. You know, I don't know if you would associate ambition with your music or yourself. I don't know how you feel about ambition.
Well, you know, I think it's like, I think before I had kids, I did just a very, very, very small amount of touring. You know, I sang and played guitar in a band called Full Shen, who are on Asthmatic Kitty Records. And I did a tour with them. And then I just tour managed Alex's band Yo-Ya for one tour. And in terms of ambition, like, I grew up thinking about my upbringing and where I grew up, I've made it. I live in Los Angeles. I have electricity in my house and heat, and I have running water, and I have kids, and I have two cars.
Whoa.
and I have guitars, and like, so in terms of ambition, like I've been without all those things. And so I don't need anything more. Anything more is like a cherry on top at this point. And having toured, I think that's not my cherry on top. Like, for me, I'm like, Los Angeles and Southern California are so big in terms of like, you can't play every indie rock bar dive venue in Southern California in a year.
Like, right.
You know? So, I mean, I always kind of like joked about it, but I'm just like, you know, I could save a lot of time and gas and money if I wanted to play, you know, 8 shows in 9 days, it would not be out of the realm of, you know, reality to do San Diego to LA and hit 8 different, totally different audiences, you know, if you're playing 100 cap venue or something like that, 200 cap venue, you know, that's like, I don't know. So I don't have to travel. I don't feel like my ambition is to be like, oh, you know, I want to take my act on the road and then be away from home. And I mean, Claire's in the band. Claire's my wife. So, I mean, obviously we get to do that together. That's fun. But, but we have the kids and stuff. And like, yeah, that ambition of like now raising good people and raising kind kids and still making time to music, which is harder to do now because I have all these other things going on, but, you know, is very special times now, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
You know, some people put everything, all their expectations, all their world into the one pursuit, which I don't think is necessarily that healthy.
But people find it hard if you well, because again, what's the pursuit? The pursuit of like what's the ambition to,
what's the goal
to make? Yeah, is it to like make a living?
That's the base. I mean, sometimes people have a legacy.
And then where do you live? Because making a living and basing yourself out of Akron, Ohio, and making a living and basing yourself out of West Hollywood, Los Angeles, you know, like those making a living might look a little different. you know?
Sure, sure. And, no, they're quite like, different.
Right, you know, I don't know. For me, I found it very liberating to not... You can't... There's always an aspect, I think, I believe there's always an aspect of luck in success when it comes to, like, art and music. And that springs from, that idea springs from seeing incredibly, incredibly talented musicians out here not, quote unquote, making it or not making a living, even though they are masters at their instrument or whatever. And that's just because of, like, for whatever reason, like, luck, like, things just haven't, like, lined up for them. So I found it very liberating to be like, you know, unlike an actor, where an actor has to book a gig, right? An actor has to, like, book a TV show or a play or a movie to act, mm-hmm. I think. Whereas a musician, in my experience, no one has to give me permission to write a song. And,
right.
And as long as I can make friends with, like, one band that does play at a venue, then I can play a venue through my friend. They book the show and I open for them. And I don't know, that point of entry, I think, as a musician means that I can exist very much like, you know, calling myself like a musician. And I don't know, that point of entry, I can do it. I can be a musician because I can stay home, I can write the stuff, I can practice playing live, and then I can play live. And it's not necessarily like how often I play live, but as long as I do it sometimes, I'm a musician, you know? Like, I don't know, it's different from acting or whatever. But yeah, so in that sense, like, I find that, like, really liberating to be like, yeah, you know, it's not going to be about making money doing this in order to be that thing.
Yeah, and it never has been about that, correct? Yeah. You've never had that as a pursuit.
No.
So how do you make money, if you don't mind me asking?
I work for Emerson College in Boston. Emerson College is an arts and communications school, and they have a satellite campus in Hollywood. And so I'm director of events and IT out here. And so I run a team that navigates the networking, IT and AV infrastructure of this building and, like, the rentals of the building.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I do that. And I work 36.25 hours a week doing that, give or take.
That's tight.
And I get paid to do that. And I found that, like, living in a capitalist society, that it was easier to make money doing that, and then I could still be a musician. I could still have my band. And I could still, like, get together with my friends and play music. And, like, the only thing I can't do is, like, go on a 3-week tour all the time.
Right.
And be, like, cold. Because I live in Los Angeles and it's not that cold here. So instead, I get to live in this, like, nice, dry, warm climate, which is what I was raised in Southern Africa and Australia, and now here. And yeah, I can contribute to supporting my family, and I got my kids, and you know, we can eat, and they can go to dance class, they can go to daycare. Oh my God, don't get me started. Just in terms of cost.
So how much time do you find in a week now to make music?
To make music? Oh, it depends on how late I want to stay up.
Yeah.
I could find plenty of time to make music. I'm tired most nights. My kids wake up at 6 and they go to bed at 6. And then, you know, we have a routine of, like, prepping everything for the next day. So you got to, like, do the dishes, do the laundry, clean up, like, whatever the kids have been, like, playing with, pack 5 lunches, That's for everybody. I don't have five kids. I got three kids.
Yeah.
For those who don't know. And then I have to make the decision. Do I spend some time with Claire? Do I spend some time with my partner? Right. And so if we want to hang out, maybe we'll watch something or we'll play a board game. As you know, I love playing. We love playing games mm-hmm. out here. So are we going to play a nice little duel of Settlers of Catan or what? And then I have to decide whether I want to go to bed. It'll be like 9 o'clock, 9:30. Do I want to go to bed or do I want to go downstairs and do music? So, I mean, I can do it as much or as little as I want. I would say, you know, I probably come down and play music maybe 3 times a week. But it's very easy for me to just like come down at 9 PM and then just be here till like 1 AM and be like, oh man, like my kids are waking up at 6. They don't know I stayed up like working on demos. They don't care. They're like, wake up, Dad. So yeah, but the thing is, Michael, and this is the sad existence of ugly. This is
okay,
a sad
let's
existence.
Get in. Yeah,
and,
let's get sad.
And I think people, you take this one, is I do a lot of solo writing. And that's the saddest time actually, is just when I'm alone creating these really fun songs.
Why is it sad?
Because the most fun thing to do is to sit with your friends and write really fun songs. And so it's fun. Like I take my little songs and my little chord progressions or riffs or whatever, basically fully formed. And I take those to the band and I say, oh, I had this idea, and it goes like this, this, this. And I do a little verbal explanation, and then Alex and Ian and Claire like bring it to life. And then Alex and Ian, because they're on the more tonal instrument, you know, Alex is doing bass and they're figuring out like that, like rhythm section. They come up with the ideas and the spice to like make the songs like a little more exciting. And those moments are like the most fun. But you know, Ugly Sweaters, you listen to it and like 90%, maybe more of like everything you hear is like on a little demo that I did on my V drums and by myself layering all the instruments, in terms of composition.
Gotcha.
And I do wish that like my existence, like a perfect existence. Yes, I get to play with my friends, but like the perfect existence would also be to like write more with my friends. But Alex and Ian are so at a level where, you know, they're too efficient, because I can bring them my songs and they put all the good stuff in like a 2-hour session. So they don't need to be hanging out with me 3 times a week, you know, working on tunes. We just don't work that way. They're just like, yeah.
All right. So what do you got coming up? You got it?
Man, we got
anything?
I got tunes. Okay. We had, when did we do our last recording session? It's a long time ago. Cause my little dude is one in November. So, usually the way these things work is we do a bit of recording, right before somebody gets born. So hopefully we'll break that cycle. Cause I can't have any more kids. We gotta break the cycle. But but yeah, we recorded this EP. I don't know if it's gonna be called Driving Fast, but yeah, we released Driving Fast, which was fun, and we released East Bay Love from that batch of songs. And again, the way we record is like, we play shows and I insert new songs into the shows. And I feel like if the band vibes with the song, we'll insert them into the set list, and then we'll play those. And if it makes it into like, if a song makes it into the set list consistently, then we'll be like, oh, okay, that one we'll record, you know, in 2 years when we sit back down. And then we record everything in like a day. Right. Yeah. We record the EPs. Cause again, like, you know, we're working out of Alex's house. So if you listen back to the last two EPs that have come out, and the new one that's on ice that we're gonna we're going to put out. That's all like drums are all in Alex's living room. Bass is DI'd and then reamped. And the guitar is in his bedroom. And then the vocals are in his little like back studio room. And we just do it at his house in a day. And I just come back and I do like solos and extra vocals, like, you know, the next day or something like that. And then Alex, you know, produces it and puts it together. But yeah, we got some songs. We got some songs. I don't know. Again, I don't know what it's going to be called. I don't have artwork for it. So I got to talk to, Neve Bavarsky. Obviously, you know Neve from your books and all your things and your podcast. And yeah, maybe we'll talk to Neve and get some visual for it, and put it out. But again, I'm not like, I got to figure out schedules with Alex and Ian and when they're going to be in LA.
Right.
Next. Ian's housemate does some like 8-track recordings. So he's got like an 8-track recorder. And last time we were over there, he's like, oh, we should record you guys every time you guys rehearse here. I love it. So I was calling Alex this morning. I said, oh man, maybe we go over there and like do some recordings that way, which would be kind of fun. Cause I feel like the band, like, because we record everything in a day, I think we try and get like that energy of the live show because the live show is, you know, the first EP we did, I think was a bit, it's really the drumming is so good. The bass is so good, but I think my performance is like a little bit dialed down. The songs have changed a little bit, my writing has developed a little bit more and it might be just naturally a bit more energetic, but now like, man, you come to the show, it's going to be like high energy. And so we try and capture that. And yeah, I think like recording like a live thing, would be fun. Would be like good. Capture that lightning.
No, I feel you. All right. So people need to keep an ear out.
Oh yeah. Keep an ear out. And, we'll see if I can, squeeze a show between Alex and Ian's, other things. But I got to get back into it. You know, the pandemic was weird and we slowed things down with that. And the kids weren't vaccinated, cause they couldn't be, cause there wasn't the kid vaccine for a while and then they couldn't get it till they're X amount of months old and stuff like that. So we really hung out at home, through a lot of the pandemic just for health things. And, so yeah, I feel like I got to get back into the LA scene a little bit more and, figure out what places didn't shutter.
Yep.
But Michael, you got your spot. Let's go to you. Let's go play at your spot.
Well, that'd be great.
That's right around the corner, right?
Yeah, I live next to it. But that'd be amazing because I actually have a basement studio that's like could be really good for that kind of energy, real tight.
How many?
No, I would definitely.
What's your fire code capacity for the basement?
I can't speak to that publicly.
Oh, I see. Are you getting some hardcore bands through there, Michael?
I don't even know what hardcore means.
You don't know hardcore?
I realized the other day.
Listen to some like Mind Force.
I mean, it's not very descriptive, is it? Hardcore what?
Hardcore punk, I guess.
Then I don't think so yet. Yeah, you got to remember, there's a lot of emo out here still. I don't know how that's possible.
Okay.
But
it's a lot of like bangs that people use to.
They're still
straightening
emo.
Their hair. Dang.
It's wild. We've had a couple of metal shows.
Okay.
In the past 2 months, but I legit just don't know what hardcore is. So
okay.
I'll keep an eye out for that.
Listen to End It, Michael. End It.
End It.
End It.
End
from Baltimore.
Okay.
Yeah, End It. There you go. Woo! End It. You're gonna love it. Woo. So good. So good. Throw it. Get End It in your basement, man. That'll be a sick show.
I'll look into it. Yeah. End It.
End It.
I wonder what they're trying to end, huh?
Dude, all kinds of things. They're a sick band, dude. Yeah, no joke, man. They're rad. They're rad. Yeah. I just hear basement and I think like, oh man, nice sweaty show.
Exactly.
I still got many questions about the religious component, but for a different time.
That's right. That's right. We'll talk more.
All right.
You go get your beauty sleep.
You too.
Thanks, man. Been a pleasure, dude. Mm-hmm. I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
All right, night.
Music by Dori Bavarsky and Mingja Chen. Next up, we have Anthony Visco. Have a good week.
Mama Cosi Daily.